Because of listeners like you, Preborn has helped to rescue over 67,000 babies. Your $28 to sponsor one ultrasound doubled a baby's chance at life. Your tax-deductible gift saves lives. Please join us in this mission. To donate, go to preborn.com/AFR.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. It is Friday, October 17th, and a lot going on for reporters and also Secretary of War Pete Hegseth, whose plane landed yesterday under, you know, some kind of circumstances, and everything is okay, at least reportedly, which is good. But this coming from the AP, journalists turn in access badges, exit Pentagon, rather than agree to new reporting rules. And so, you know, journalists just always think that they're, you know, better than the people that they're covering. And obviously there are rights and protections for journalists, and we want that because journalism is actually important. But a lot of people who call themselves journalists really are nothing better than activists. But anyway, this coming from the AP, dozens of reporters turned in access badges and exited the Pentagon on Wednesday rather than agree to government-imposed restrictions on their work, pushing journalists who cover the American military further from the seat of its power. The nation's leadership calls the new rules, quote unquote, common sense to help regulate a very disruptive press. I tend to agree with that. News outlets were nearly unanimous in rejecting new rules imposed by Defense Secretary, which, see, the AP won't even call him Secretary of War, right? So they're still calling him Defense Secretary. So this means that the journalists at the AP are still activists. But anyway, Secretary of War, we'll get it right, Pete Hegseth, that would leave journalists vulnerable to expulsion if they sought to report on information classified or otherwise that had not been approved by Hegseth for release. So let's welcome in Scott Uhlinger, who's a former CIA officer. And Scott, you know, this this seems to be, you know, interesting that at least, you know, a lot of these journalists are exiting rather than agreeing to the new reporting rules. How do you see these new rules being implemented? Are they fair?
Yeah, well, I certainly think that the rules are fair. By the way, in addition to the CIA, I also served 28 years in the U.S. Navy combined active and reserve time. So I've had my whole life I've been in the military, basically. But the way I understand it is that previously journalists were, or at least certainly this is the last several years, perhaps going back more than a decade, they had journalists had free rein to just wander the corridors of the Pentagon, which is absolutely crazy that they would be allowed to do that. And so they could, you know, sniff out various things and certainly report on things that it was not in the interests of national security to report. And then we go back to the fact that literally every single mainstream media outlet has almost 100% negative coverage of Hegseth, of Peter Hegseth. And so it comes back to the question of accountability. If you are going to drag someone's name through the mud constantly, why should they help you in destroying, you know, why should I help somebody in destroying me? It's ridiculous. And so this is a little bit of the accountability that is being welcomed and imposed by Hegseth on the military, and the press is going to have to follow along and go by journalistic standards and ethics in dealing with the U.S. Department of War.
Yeah, and I mean, and this seems just really common sense that while journalists, you know, claim they need access and they need to be able to, you know, cover things fairly and all of that, they're not entitled to unfettered access to information to release to the public. And so these new rules to me are just simple guardrails to say that, you know, if you're going to be here in the Pentagon and actually have access to that building, which a lot of outlets, I mean, you know, American Family News, which is the news affiliate of the American Family Radio Network, you know, we don't have a full-time reporter that's getting access to the Pentagon. And so it's very selective anyway. So it's not like there's an entitlement to journalists, you know, writ large, to access that. But if they're able, if there are some select few who are able to go into the Pentagon, it seems completely fair to say, you know, there needs to be some standards and guardrails here to ensure that there's not basically what amounts to leaking.
That's right. And I mean, we look at, you know, this similar, basically similar practices being taken at, in the White House press room. I mean, basically, if you're not willing to follow the rules, then there's the door, you know, and don't let it hit you on your way out, because there are plenty of up and coming real journalists, podcasters, et cetera, the kind of people that the journalists, quote unquote, despise, but they are basically of the people, and they are reporting much more honestly. And why not welcome them into the White House press room and into the Pentagon if they're going to follow the rules? The people who don't want to follow the rules can, you know, can walk out. And that's exactly what they did, further showing you how disconnected the journalist, quote unquote, class is from the American people. They're not, you know, they're willing to basically, in my opinion, they're willing to sacrifice U.S. lives if it makes Trump or the Secretary of War look bad. I mean, they would leak something that could lead to the deaths of soldiers or sailors, and it wouldn't matter to them as long as they can accomplish a political agenda. The American people understand that, and that's why this is something that the American people just shrug their shoulders and go, okay, and move on with their day.
Yeah, and I think a lot of this, frankly, has come from President Trump for years and years, rightly, saying that the press is very dishonest, you know, the press is fake news, and, you know, really calling out these activists and so-called journalists for, you know, really not actually doing their job. It's not necessarily that they're holding an administration or leadership accountable, which is obviously something that is good to do, but they're trying, some of them are trying intentionally, in my view, to undermine the administration. And so when they have this kind of access, it would make sense to say, well, there is a flow of information, but we have to make sure that that ultimately, you know, doesn't result in information getting out when it's not supposed to. So, so do you anticipate any, you know, challenges to this and the journalists who walked out? I mean, I'm kind of frankly, I would be inclined, if I were Hegseth, to just be like, all right, good riddance, you know, less people that'll be in the building to leak, you know, too bad for you.
Right. I mean, I think that that is what will happen. I mean, you know, they really don't have a leg to stand on. They don't really have a case to make. Certainly, you know, the Pentagon can invoke questions of national security that really are, even the courts, I think, will have a very hard time blocking such a thing. So they're making a big, fracas right now, but they're going to have to toe the line and follow what is the rules that have been laid down. So, you know, this is a positive thing, because also, it will maybe make these people understand a little bit about accountability, because there isn't any, especially in the journalistic core, as it were. I think the worst thing is not only are they incredibly biased, but their primary weapon is the sin of omission, is what they choose to not cover is at least as important as what they choose to cover. And we can see that across our whole society, not reporting on things that don't fulfill their agenda. So they just ignore it. And so that's what you see with defense reporting. They don't report things that would make Trump look good. The same way that, you know, after this peace agreement, there's no one posting anything who were anti-Trump. They have nothing to say now because they don't know what to say. So we're seeing a similar thing with the, quote, professionals, unquote, of the journalistic corps.
Yeah, and you actually took the next segue, you know, completely spot on. And I'm speaking with Scott Uhlinger, who is a former CIA officer and, you know, has been around for years and years of seeing the fake news. And, you know, with the peace deal, There were so many journalists that prior to this actually happening were saying, oh, President Trump can't accomplish it. And there's no way. I mean, even, you know, one of the morons on The View saying, I'll wear a MAGA hat if he gets it done. We're still kind of waiting for that. But now that this actually has been accomplished, a few of them are giving Trump credit, but, you know, a lot of them aren't. But, you know, that's just kind of the standard fare, I think, for the fake news media, that nobody is really paying attention and they've lost a lot of their bully pulpit. But speaking of Israel, Scott, you know, just in the last, you know, few days, Israel has accused Hamas already of violating the Trump peace deal, mainly because it alleges failing to turn over the remains of all of the hostages within 72 hours. President Trump said on Wednesday that Hamas was, quote, still digging for the remains, and he issued a new warning for the group to disarm. That came from NBC News and a few other outlets. So what do you anticipate to happen here in terms of Hamas actually moving forward with this? I don't think Trump is inclined to suggest, you know, that, yeah, there's been a violation, peace deal off. I mean, he's going to try to keep this together, obviously.
Right. But what I have seen, some of the things I've seen, see, I'm much more very skeptical of this peace plan simply because it isn't simply not in Hamas's nature to obey this. And they will do anything throughout, I don't care how long this is in effect, quote unquote, they will do anything to wheedle, to weasel, to cheat, to undercut their way through this. And so I'm not sure about the long-term viability of this agreement. Unfortunately, we're seeing right now that it is difficult. So, okay, the living hostages have been turned over, but they are delaying the bodies. And the reason is because they're afraid of forensic pathology. The fact that no females were turned over living indicates that they had something to hide, and they're afraid now because, you know, the Arab world always has a love-hate relationship with Israel. They hate them, but at the same time, they are in awe of their technical and organizational capability. So regardless of what the Israelis can find out from forensic pathology, the Arabs and Hamas in particular is very fearful of what the Israelis are capable of doing with those unfortunate bodies. So I'm expecting that there, and again, you're right, Trump wants this, you know, kind of smooth this over. He wants this to work kind of, but there will come a time perhaps where he won't be able to do that anymore. We can actually look at Ukraine to see kind of a guideline for that. You know, Trump was trying to smooth things over with Putin, trying to work his way through, but in the end, he finally realized that, okay, this, my technique of giving them the benefit of the doubt, of extending, you know, giving him the ability to, you know, kind of get along with me is not working anymore. So I'm going to have to cut the cord. And so now we have a dramatic change in the war in our attitude toward the war in Ukraine. And unfortunately, such a thing could also happen with this peace agreement. So Trump will try to hold it together as best he can. But if we keep on going more than a month with this kind of back and forth without progress, then he's going to probably go to Netanyahu and say, okay, you know, do what you have to do. He wouldn't like to do that because of the sort of a loss of face for Trump to a degree. But at the same time, he's not afraid to face reality ultimately. So, and we also have to keep in mind that, that again, this is from what I've read, and I wasn't in the room, so I don't know for sure, but there are certainly some people saying that Hamas has not actually signed anything, that the group, that the parties were meeting in Egypt were discussing other things and other agreements, that there was not actually a meeting where Hamas signed a treaty. It's all kind of verbal agreements, sort of, no official signing of anything. And so that makes it also very difficult to nail down.
Yeah, well, really well said. And, you know, we'll see how this continues and hope for the best. I'm like you. I really don't trust Hamas or Qatar or, you know, any of these other nations. I don't think that They are actually looking for peace. They're looking for jihad. And so it's going to be interesting to see how they move forward with this and ultimately what Israel asks of Donald Trump. But Scott Uhlinger, always appreciate your commentary. As always, we'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning. We're living in a time when truth is under attack. Lies are easy to tell, easy to spread, and easy to believe. But truth? Truth is costly. And nowhere is the cost greater than for mothers in crisis. When a woman is told abortion is her only option, silence and lies surround her. But when she walks into a preborn network clinic, she's met with compassion, support, and the truth about the growing life inside her. That moment of truth happens through a free ultrasound, and it's a game changer. When a mother sees her baby and hears that heartbeat, it literally doubles the chance she will choose life. Preborn Network clinics are on the front lines, meeting women in their darkest hour, loving them, helping them choose life, and sharing the truth. Friend, this is not the time to be silent. It is the time for courage, for truth, and for life. Just $28 provides one ultrasound and the opportunity for a mother to see her baby to help her choose truth and choose life. Please donate today. Call #250 and say baby. That's #250 baby, or give online at preborn.com/AFR. That's preborn.com/AFR.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. Well, this is Justin reported by Fox News that stunning data reveals that Christianity is surging in the United States, at least according to the data. So since 2022, so yeah, this isn't just since Charlie Kirk's assassination, but since 2022, annual U.S. Bible sales are up 41.6%. Religion and spirituality app downloads since 2019 are up 79.5%. And contemporary Christian music, Spotify streams since 2019 are up 50%. So does this kind of data really indicate Christian revival? Well, you know, I'm not really sure, especially in the religion and spirituality app downloads. I mean, there is a ton. Like, anybody who's on any of these dating apps, and like, unfortunately, I have been, my cousins have been, and we all send each other, you know, the profiles of like all of these people that are just, it's just so sad how inconsistent people are. But there are a lot of people that would say that they're Christians, but they don't know what it means, or they'll say spiritual but not religious, or yes, I'm spiritual because I believe in a higher power, whatever. So I think that especially that category, to say that, oh, since 2019, you know, it's up almost 80%. Well, what apps are we actually talking about? You know, this seems to maybe kind of overinflate the data. But let's welcome in Mike Donnelly, who is an attorney, a Christian, a homeschool father, and one of our favorite guests on this program. So, Mike, you know, we talked a little bit in the break about, you know, your skepticism of, you know, kind of this mass revival. I think that tempered skepticism, but hopeful prayer, you know, is maybe the best route. So what are your thoughts?
Oh, Jenna, it's great to be with you. Good morning, everyone. Great to be with you this morning and chatting with you on a subject a little bit different from what we usually talk about, which is the Constitution, constitutional law, what's happening at Supreme Court laws. As a lawyer, I get to be a little bit of a commentator here on culture, which I enjoy doing. So it's great to have a talk with you about that. Jenna, you know, the devil's in the details, right? I think you're right to be pointing out what apps are we talking about here. You know, there's all kinds of spiritual apps, and what kind of spirituality are we talking about? I think, you know, when we go back and look at the history of this question about Christianity in America, you know, since the 1990s, we've seen a massive drop from those who identify themselves as Christians and believing in God, from the 90% to the 60%. It's been decade by decade by decade, down, down, down. Also associated with that has been regular church attendance, from 40%+ in the 90s or early 2000, down, down, down to 30%. And so when you ask yourself, you know, if Bible sales are increasing,
people are downloading apps and they're listening to more so-called Christian music on Spotify, does that mean there's Christian revival going on? I don't think we can, you know, jump to that conclusion just yet. But I'm, you know, are people curious? That's a good thing. I think that's an indicator that people are curious about it, and that's better than the numbers continuing to drop, in my opinion. You know, different polls suggest that maybe we've stabilized in the 60 to 65, 67% range of people who self-identify as believing in God or Christians. There's more people who say they believe in God, about 73% Gallup poll in 23 said they believe in God, versus, you know, who say they're a Christian, because obviously the devils believe in God, right? I mean, they know that God exists. That doesn't mean that you're a Christian just because you believe in God. That number, though, when you look at Gallup polls, also down from the 90% mark in 2001. So, you know, what's been going on in our country over the last three decades? I'm not really sure, but maybe we've hit the bottom. And that, you know, if we've hit the bottom, that's good. Now we have an opportunity to encourage people to pursue a saving faith in Christ, which ultimately is the most important question that any of us can ask any of our friends or family who do not have a relationship with God through Jesus Christ. It's like, where are you going to spend eternity? And, you know, hopefully in the coming holiday season, we'll have opportunities to talk with our friends and family about that.
Yeah. And, you know, I think that that's a really interesting point to go back to, you know, the data that has shown actually a national decline in terms of a professed belief or in Christian truth, and even, you know, identifying as an evangelical or a Christian or a Catholic, you know, all that is actually declining. And it's interesting to see kind of over the decades, you know, this sort of, you know, rise and fall of the mainstream lie of the culture that that is the kind of the flavor of maybe, you know, the year, the decade, the era, you know, whatever time quantity you want to have. And, you know, I remember just back, like right as the trans movement was kind of starting to come into view, talking, you know, with the Colson Fellows and John Stone Street, you know, who hosts Breakpoint and some of those, you know, about living in a post-truth society. And the big issue was relativism, and to say, you know, what was my truth versus your truth, and let's, you know, attack this cultural lie kind of head on. And then it became, you know, this whole LGBTQ, and then, and first it was the LGB, and then, you know, we hadn't even contemplated trans yet. But it seems like, you know, a lot of these things are perhaps falling away in Gen Z. I mean, it was interesting, just this past Wednesday night, I went and did a kind of Charlie Kirk style Q&A with my church's youth group, and it was amazing. There were probably, you know, 7,500 kids there who were middle school and high school aged. And we asked them to submit some of the questions beforehand, and then, you know, got to live questions if we could. And interestingly, not one question was about trans, gender, sexual orientation, sexuality, none of that among, you know, all of these questions. And my pastor had said that another local church had done kind of a similar thing. And in over 200 questions from their students, there was maybe like not even 1% that dealt with those issues. And so is this more than, you know, Mike, do you see this more as maybe the overall Christianity is still falling, but maybe the persistent lie of the culture is just changing?
Well, that's a good question. And I find it interesting that you did a discussion with your youth group, because I did that last night with our youth group at our church.
Amazing.
We had a panel discussion with a few of the youth leaders, and we also did the same thing. We got questions from our young people, and I kind of curated them, and I moderated the panel. And we had one question about the transgender issue, which was the person asking, how do we reach out to these people? Kind of like what we talked about on our Chile's V. Salazar discussion in the podcast last week, where, you know, recognizing that these people are lost and confused, and they're caught up in this moment, this mania, this you know, what Al Mohler called on his podcast on this issue just today or yesterday or whatever, a social contagion, this transgenderism. And what we see is a dramatic drop in the number of young people in Gen Z who are identifying as non-binary, right? Non-binary meaning, I hate to use the language, but, you know, not male or female, but something else. Like, okay, you can't be something else. There's only one or the other, but it is what it is. And that those numbers have dropped by about 50% in some recent surveys over the last just 2 years, from like 9% in some populations or 6% identifying as so-called transgender to 2 or 3%, which shows that's massive. That's a massive inflection point. And so could we be reaching the end of the growth of this social contagion that's driven by confusion and peer pressure and enabled by leftism and progressivism who want people to separate the soul from the body and you can decide for yourself what you are, you know, the relativism that you're talking about where we go back to the garden itself, which we talked about on the podcast. People should go back and listen to the podcast. We spent an hour talking about this issue. You know, what was the lie that Adam and Eve bought, that you can be like God, deciding for yourselves good and evil? And, you know, maybe people are realizing that, no, you're either a male or a female, and we're coming to the end of this phase, I hope, of the T in the LGBT. Where do we go from there? Not sure, but it's so harmful, this T. You know, the procedures that some of these young people are being subjected to, you know, altering their body, destroying their ability to have children, cutting off parts of their body that are irreparable. This is incredible. I cannot believe that we are doing this. It's unbelievable. And I'm glad that some state legislatures are stepping in to ban these procedures, but then you still have lots of others who are wanting to continue this kind of thing. And then you've got some states that are like Colorado, your home state, which we talked about on Friday, trying to ban even allowing licensed counselors to help young people who are experiencing some mental health or confusion around this issue. So, you know, are we at the end of it? Clearly we're not at the end of it, but there are some signs that are pointing to maybe people are starting to figure out that this isn't something that they want to experiment with.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, I mean, and as we did talk about, and for those of you who missed that conversation, you can go to AFR.net, click on the icon for podcast. It's the on-demand podcast that drops most Fridays, and listen to that conversation. That's an extended conversation with my guest this morning, Mike Donnelly, on, you know, all of this. And, you know, one of the things we talked about on that program was about how the church has to be prepared to deal with those who bought into this lie and have lasting and permanent physical damage because of the lie. And we need to be prepared to meet that with hope, with truth, and with the word of God. And you know, and we didn't actually talk before this program about the various, you know, conversations at our respective youth groups, Mike, but I find that, you know, really encouraging that so many churches are doing that, especially in light of recognizing how hungry young people are to ask questions and have those answers. And one of the things that I found at my church's youth group was how much they were paying attention and really genuinely wanted answers, not from a necessarily a skepticism standpoint, but to be able to more robustly defend their faith. And that's encouraging. But I think that that's because a lot of these kids come from Christian homes. And, you know, you're a homeschool father. I'm a homeschool graduate. And I firmly believe that homeschooling is the best practice for Christian discipleship from parents. And when we're seeing the utter nonsense going on in academia and in college, the best way to not have young people buy into those lies is to allow them to graduate high school with the tools to not only defend their faith, but to be grounded in their faith because of discipleship from their parents for, you know, 18 plus years. And so I know you have been an advocate previously at the Homeschool Legal Defense Association for homeschooling. And so, you know, share a little bit, if you could, about, you know, that correlation and how you've personally, you and your wife, Patty, have experienced that kind of discipleship opportunity comparatively with, you know, a lot of these kids that are still searching for truth because they didn't grow up in a Christian home.
Well, I didn't grow up in a Christian home either, and I came to Christ when I was in law school, so miracles do happen. But it has been a real privilege for me and my wife to homeschool our seven children for going on 20, 25 years now, and we still have a couple still at home, and it's been a great journey. But the thing is this, regardless of whether your children go to a public, private, or if you homeschool them, you know, we as parents do have an obligation to give them Christian education and to equip them with answers to these questions. And I will tell you that homeschooling is not a panacea. It is not a guarantee that your children are going to become, you know, followers of Jesus Christ. It gives you an opportunity, unlike, you know, maybe people whose kids go to public or private schools, to invest in them, to spend a lot of time with them. And you just have more time when you're homeschooling because you're not doing all the silly stuff of, you know, institutional learning, as I like to call it. But, you know, parents, you know, ultimately are empowered by God to make that decision. And I never fault anyone for the decision they make, but I do encourage people to take it seriously. And if your kids are going to a public school, you're fighting an uphill battle. You know, as many good things that are happening in our country, God is not welcome in the public schools, you know, more so now than ever. But it's a difficult place. And it's hard to give your children a Christian education when you're sending them off to be taught by somebody else who probably isn't a Christian and isn't allowed to teach them the truth for 6 to 8 hours a day, and then put them around a bunch of other kids who come from mostly secular homes and are encouraging them to not care about their faith. Now, on the flip side, there are a lot of young people in my youth group and that I know who go to public school and are strong Christians, and that's an opportunity for them to develop and test their faith in those kinds of circumstances. So it's an individual decision, but it's a great way for kids to learn, I think, to explore what their interests are. I mean, I love that about homeschooling. You know, my youngest son is interested in being a pilot. He's 14 years old. He's already got a bunch of flight hours because we got time to go bring him up to the airport so he can, you know, learn how to fly an airplane and maybe become a commercial airline pilot as quickly as possible, or to test it out and see, oh, you know, I really don't like flying. Like me, put me in a Cessna 172. No, thanks. Not interested. I've been in a few and it doesn't make me feel good, but he loves it. You know, allows your kids to explore their interests in depth, unlike in other environments. So I think homeschooling is a great, and look at you. I mean, you're a great poster child for homeschooling. Jenna, you've written books and you're, you know, a radio star. So homeschooling can really work, folks. Give it a shot.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I always say that it's the best gift that my parents ever gave me, because I know that being grounded in my faith and being able to confront the lies of the world with biblical truth. And when I went to law school, be able to say, well, wait a minute, you know, let me question, you know, some of these doctrines of the Supreme Court and other things that, you know, we're just being taught as fact and as, you know, you can't argue otherwise. You know, I was willing to question those things primarily because I had an education that was grounded in truth. And so, you know, Mike is right. I really think that homeschooling provides, you know, one of the best opportunities for kids to truly be trained in the things of God. But we'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning. Follow Mike Donnelly at Donnelly Speaks on X.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. And so the Democrats are still squawking about these leaked messages on the Young Republicans group chat that they are terming racist. And a lot of these, you know, well, just a little bit ridiculous, to be honest. You know, and I definitely don't condone what was said in there. You know, some of these things were also very much taken out of context. And the Democrats are, of course, trying to use this to turn the tables and somehow get the spotlight off of how bad their own candidates are doing. And of course, the leaked chat with Jay Jones, the attorney general candidate who is running in Virginia, and then Katie Porter, who is just this, she's just going down in flames in California, yet is still polling I think, you know, the highest, which is utterly absurd that she might actually be California's governor. I mean, just California is just on a headed off a cliff. You know, it's just, it's so sad. But the group chat itself, in terms of, you know, if we take away kind of this overarching kind of bigger political narrative that we talked about this week, and you can go back to, you know, AFR.net and go to Jenna Ellis in the Morning, listen to that whole chat with Orrin McIntyre if you'd like to. I want to kind of zone in on what these text messages and this group chat does actually reveal, though, about young Republicans and kind of what their mentality is. Because when we're talking about, you know, young people and we're talking about what they're interested in, what we're talking about, you know, is the persistent lie and current flavor of the lie of the culture of being in a post-truth society, and why, you know, Gen Z is tending to be America only instead of America first. I mean, all of these different things, and how they vote, where they vote, what their political framework is, we kind of have to then parse, you know, what is their actual worldview? And for these particular group messages, what does this reveal about young Republicans that are actually engaged, obviously, in the political sphere, and what their worldview portends? So let's welcome in Mark Mitchell, who is the CEO of Rasmussen Reports. And you had a very interesting observation, Mark, that the Wire group chat explains why it shows the data on the youth on the right are not necessarily constitutionalists anymore, but more like old school European nationalists. Explain that.
Yeah, I think that's exactly what's happening. And thanks for having me back to talk about it. There's a major shift in politics in just the last couple of years in a way that I don't think either party has really wrestled with Democrat voters moving farther and farther to the left, embracing democratic socialism, communism, things that would have been anathema, you know, 20, 30 years ago under Bill Clinton. And then on the right, too, these people, according to our polling, are not conservative. Even the ones that voted for Trump, 18 to 39-year-olds, overwhelmingly supported excess wealth confiscation by almost 60%, nationalizing major industries by three-quarters, and even income caps. This is the conservatives. So I think conservatism was a nice sort of ideal for a better time, but it kind of, in my opinion, feels more like a luxury belief, the same kind of luxury beliefs that they have on the left, because these people are basically just economically in despair. They think their future has been stolen from them. They think the economy is unfair to young people. They don't think they're going to be able to afford a house. Prices are so high. And even the job market has been essentially given away to the rest of the world in a way that is just so cynical and self-serving of the establishment. So these people have been abandoned, and trying to tell them, well, you just have to do what I did, pick yourself up by your bootstraps and work harder and get hand-walk your resume to the boss. Those things don't work anymore. It's not the kind of message that these people want to hear. And I think it ties in with what we see here, which is nihilism and anger. But also there's this aspect, too, that I think we're just coming to grips with in a new way, is that I've seen the Trump online communities, and there's always been an aspect of this where people are like to be edgy. They like to be edgelords. There's memes. There's oftentimes this aspect of humor. And it makes me remember back when I was growing up, when you were actually allowed to tell jokes. I mean, it was wrong, but we all had a lot of jokes about, like, you know, there were the Polish jokes in the 80s and Helen Keller. And I mean, all of these things back before this this establishment monoculture told us that words were violence and that nobody was allowed to be offended anymore. And it was used to brutal effect, basically social engineering in order to sow division and create victim classes that are worshipped and reorganize all of our social economic hierarchy in a way that has been very damaging. And so now it's kind of weird because you're allowed to say this stuff on Twitter in a way that the establishment is not prepared for yet. And so it's brought to the forefront. It's the stuff that you saw in these chats is not anything. In fact, it's not nearly as bad as some of the stuff that's just literally everywhere on Twitter now. And I think 95 to 99% of it is people being edgy, making jokes. And again, I'm not saying whether it's right or wrong. It's just the reality. But the wildest thing, the most crazy thing, I've been talking about the Overton window and how in many ways it's still moving to the left and how in many ways nobody on the right is trying to move it back to the right. Well, just in the last 24 hours, there was a pretty important thing that I think happened that might help move the Overton window back in the right direction. And I'm not talking about, again, supporting the contents of these texts. I'm talking about going to a situation where words are not violence because we have a First Amendment protected free speech, and maybe people need a little bit thicker skin. And that's the fact that J.D. Vance came out and didn't abandon these people when many Republican organizations did. That was astounding, that tweet he did. So I think that's going to have ramifications because somebody on Twitter really summed it up very well, which is, you know, these kids were just being idiots. They were, and, you know, some of them are adults, they're younger adults, but they were being idiots and edgy and just having fun at other people's expense. And the world would have abandoned them or cast them out or canceled them or blacklisted them from every job. And here you have J.D. Vance not abandoning these people in a very, very, very public way. And that's probably a really important message for these people, you know, that no, society doesn't want to cast you aside. So I don't know where it's going to go, but they, I think on the left, you can see, well, this is probably validating their concerns. Like they've been looking for things like this. And now if you go to Reddit politics, I looked last night and 60% of the trending posts were about this or that Nazi flag they found in that Republican lawmaker office. So this is a conversation we're going to have more and more of, I think. And like racism before it, this idea of anti-Semitism or hate or whatever misogyny was in there, these words don't matter as much. They literally overuse the word racist to the point where less than 10% of Americans are concerned about being even called racist anymore. So, and I think part of that comes along with this this idea that basically society is decaying as part of the fourth turning, where there's increasing anger, increasing fear about violence, increasing mistrust in institutions and the federal government, and people don't want to be told, well, no, you can't say things anymore, especially after the Democrats were trying to throw people who question the efficacy of vaccines in jail. I mean, COVID was the ultimate weaponization of liberal groupthink in order to suppress free speech. Well, this is free speech, and it's back, and I don't think people are fully come to grips with what it means yet.
Yeah, and you know, all of this is a really fascinating conversation, especially you know, the part that when you're talking about how a lot of this reflects more of the old European nationalism and more of, you know, more of that than necessarily just the godless populism that has characterized a lot of the engagement with the MAGA movement. I mean, obviously not MAGA overall. You still have, you know, evangelicals and Christians that are ardently part of that movement. And, you know, Trump wouldn't have won without the evangelical Christian bloc, certainly. But this is a really, you know, fascinating distinction because as we move forward with what is inevitably a post-Trump American era, and people are asking, you know, who is going to carry the flag for the right, however we want to define that. This kind of chat, you know, kind of revealing more of the nationalistic tendency rather than traditional roots of conservatism should be concerning. And, you know, and there's a concept for listeners, you know, in law called legitimacy. And, you know, to say that if something is legitimate, it has to have an authority that is valid, appropriate, rightful standard. And we all know inherently, we use that term all the time outside of a legal context even, of whether an authority is legitimate or illegitimate. We characterize, you know, even the Revolutionary War, was that legitimate or illegitimate? But always in the context of at least traditionally, legitimacy has always carried an intrinsic aspect of morality, which has gone to a divine creator and from God himself. He is the author of all authority, and so therefore imbues legitimacy to that which follows his authority, and anything that's separate and apart from truth objectively is illegitimate. And interestingly, you know, this whole populism or old European nationalism, Mark Mitchell, you know, is fascinating because it really is taking away the necessary element of legitimacy being grounded in moral authority and divine order, and rooting that in more of a secular humanist type of theory that's more just about the nation and the people, and that we the people get to determine our subjective reality. And if we go along that strain as the party of the right, we're very quickly, in my opinion, going to lose, because if it's just, you know, my truth versus your truth, we're kind of back to relativism and we're back arguing on a secular humanist playing field. And then really, it's not about divine moral order and legitimacy at all. It's just about raw power.
Yeah. I mean, this is the question I think that is going to play out. And I'll probably say something here that many on the left would call me a Christian nationalist for saying, but I ask these people this question as a thought experiment, which is, in a world without Christianity, why on earth would any person be elected as a representative of you and then go to Washington, D.C. and make decisions that are in your best interest and not theirs? And without something like the foundation of Christian morality, the answer is, well, probably a whole bunch of stuff about philosophy. And what's kind of weird about this is that it's not a religious Christian movement. Obviously, there are a lot of people in it. But when you look at the country in ID, it's still over 60% ID Christian in my polling, you know, roughly 20% evangelicals. The evangelicals are way, way more traditionally conservative. The Protestants basically just poll like regular Americans who are unreligious when it comes down to values. And 72% last time I checked actually said yes to the whole concept of John 3:16. But then the last time we asked, only 61% identified it as at least somewhat religious, only 24% very religious, only 18% of 18 to 29-year-olds said they were very religious. But here's the thing. I mean, I'm watching videos. I'm trying to understand the youth. And again, there are MAGA supporting 18 to 29s. There are the Charlie Kirk people. There are those folks. But they're not the majority. And if you want to plug into who I think the majority is, well, you have to go onto YouTube. You have to look at Twitch. You have to look at streaming culture. You have to look at Reddit. And, of course, Reddit is full of LGBT, open communists, anti-capitalists, postmodernists. But what's weird is that on YouTube, you have all these non-political people who are political. So one of the guys I watch is Asmund Gold. He's just a streamer, and he is not a conservative by any stretch of the imagination. If anything, he's just fiercely independent, and one of these people that makes content focused on creating objective, logical takes on what he sees around him. And I just watched him react to a video where he basically said, this is demonic. It needs to be burned down. I'm ready to be Christian or whatever. You know, like, there's this aspect of, even though these people aren't religious, they're looking at the insanity of the left around them and demanding some kind of moral framework, some kind of return to sanity, accountability. They're craving accountability and a return to the rule of law and for crackdowns and arrests. Well, one of the big ones, Moist Critical, had a video out there excoriating the Trump administration because of its cognitive dissonance and the paradoxical views on things like, they talked about, the movement's been talking about vaccine safety for a long time, and then what happens? Well, you see Trump get the vaccine. They've been talking about Epstein for a long time, and then what happens? Well, the rug gets pulled out from underneath the Epstein case. And then they've been talking about arresting the deep state, and we're not really seeing these things. And non-MAGA supporting people who would vote for Trump, and probably many of them did, are raising their eyebrows and saying, well, I don't want the Republican Party. They don't represent me. It's not my values. It's not my worldview. We need something different, because even Trump might not be giving us what we need, which is, again, a return to a society where people don't have to worry about this stuff.
Yeah, and this is such a bigger conversation. So we'll have to do the long form podcast on this topic sometime, Mark. But thanks so much for coming back on the show this week and, you know, giving us at least just kind of that tease of, you know, this question of where are we going for conservatism and, you know, for truth in a post-Trump era. We need to continue to talk about this. So have a great weekend. And as always, you can reach me and my team, Jenna, at AFR.net. Preborn's whole mission is to rescue babies from abortion and lead their families to Christ. Last year, Preborn's network of clinics saw 8,900 mothers come to Christ. Please join us in this life-saving mission. To donate, go to preborn.com/AFR.